Welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Alice Bradley, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Jordan Calhoun, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And do we even need to say that it's been a tough year, Jordan?
Tough is an understatement, Alice, at least for most of us.
And for that very reason, we're speaking with someone who has plenty of science-backed strategies for coping during this pandemic. That person is award-winning psychology professor, Dr. Lori Santos.
If we really want to focus on what actually makes us happy, usually it's things that are much simpler than we think. It's things like taking time to be present, taking time for social connection, moving our body, getting enough sleep, right? When you go after that stuff, it doesn't feel like you're chasing after happiness. You're just like doing the stuff that you should normally do as a human.
Dr. Santos is professor of psychology and head of Silliman College at Yale University. She's an expert on human cognition and the cognitive biases that impede better choices. And her course, Psychology and the Good Life, recently became Yale's most popular course in over 300 years.
Dr. Santos is also the host of the great podcast, The Happiness Lab, which covers the latest scientific research on happiness. Recently, the podcast had a coronavirus bonus season focusing on how to take care of your mental health during this challenging time.
Alice, what do you think about when someone asks you about your happiness? Like, how do you respond to that question? I feel like it's one that you can make into like a big philosophical question. Are you happy? Or you can minimize it into, are you happy right now? Or how are you feeling? Like, how do you respond when people ask about your personal happiness?
God, people are not asking me enough. Are people coming to you and saying, Jordan, are you happy? They don't really ask me that much.
Yeah. You've never gotten that question before?
I've definitely gotten that question. But yeah, I know. I guess I have. I don't know why I'm sidestepping the question.
See, is that what you do? Is that what you do in real life, Alice? You just avoid it altogether?
Is that how you handle
this type of situation?
Oh, God.
I can't speak about this.
I don't know. I think happiness is the kind of thing, like, to me, if you think about it too much, it evades you by thinking about it. So you just kind of don't think about it.
That's what I worry about. But then you're confronted by it when someone asks you the question, right? How do you normally deal with that type of thing? If someone asks, like, if I'm asking you right now, like, Alice, are you happy? What do you say to that?
I think I would say, despite everything, I think I am pretty happy, though I don't know why. I couldn't be like, well, obviously I'm happy. I've got this, you know. Yeah, no, but when people have asked me whether or not I'm happy, I tend to say yes, but I don't really know why. I do feel like I'm a relatively cheerful person all the time, even when things kind of suck. And I think things objectively suck right now. But there's something kind of cheering to me to know that things objectively suck. Do you know what I mean? Like when things are when you should be happy and you're not, that's when I'm the most miserable.
Right. That's when you're like, what's wrong with me?
I know it's not me. It's all this.
Right.
I'm pointing to everything around me.
Now it's perfectly appropriate.
Yeah, it's appropriate.
Right? It's perfectly appropriate to not be happy. And if you are happy or if you are feeling cheerful, then it feels like a bonus. Like you are thriving in this time that is
like difficult. I'm amazingly resilient. Look at me. I feel like I'm getting bonus points.
Right.
But when it's like, you know,
exactly.
When you're in like at like, you know, Disneyland and you're like, I'm feeling really unhappy, then it's just like that's the most miserable.
I like that you use the word cheerful. I think that that's typically what I respond when I'm thinking of happiness. If I'm having a conversation with someone, what I'm really referring to is cheerfulness. Like, how am I feeling and whether I am cheerful or down, but not happy in the sense of like happy with life. I feel like it's obviously such a loaded thing because you can think of it in the context of like, are you happy with life or are you happy in the sense of, you know, the way that we think of happiness as being this end goal. Like, are you a happy person? Have you found happiness?
Yes.
I usually try to avoid the whole have you found happiness type thing and replace it with like, am I cheerful? Or like,
it's
how do I
so
feel
loaded,
right?
Right? Because there's cheerfulness, there's how contented you are with your life, and there's just how much innate joy do you feel. And I mean, joy seems to me spiritual, right? Contentedness is just, that's loaded because it's like, you know, then you're looking at your life and being like, wait, am I? Where am I in my life? And where did I think I was going to be? And am I in the right place? And that can send you down a spiral. But cheerfulness is relatively easy to accomplish.
Well, hopefully Dr. Santos can help us from separating these things and avoiding these existential crises. And we can get some tips on how we can be happier and hopefully more contented and cheerful.
And joyful and all these things. All right. No pressure, Dr. Santos. Let's go. Lori, welcome to The Upgrade.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
So how has the pandemic been treating you thus far?
It's the dumpster fire that it is for everyone, to be totally honest. My main role on campus is as a head of college, right? So that means I'm kind of a dorm mother to hundreds of students. And, you know, navigating what college life looks like when you have to wear a mask and stay 6 feet from one another is really tricky. So it's been tough, and it's involved a lot of innovation.
Yeah.
Yeah. How's that innovation looked when it comes to teaching remotely for you?
Yeah, it's been, as I said, it's been really tricky, right? Like you only, when you're teaching remotely, notice all the stuff that happens informally, you know, the like chat with somebody when they're leaving the classroom, or just like the fact that the students get together one-on-one to, you know, talk about stuff. Like, I think we are only now realizing how much of our informal interaction, the kind of office cooler conversation, we're missing out on right now. And, you know, honestly, it's really tricky to build that stuff back in. But, you know, I've been excited about how well the students are doing. You know, colleges vary, but actually at Yale, you know, the students have been able to keep the virus under control. They've been able to kind of forge new social connections. I think if anything, the fact that we're on screen so much means that students are valuing their in-person connection, you know, like sitting out in the cold courtyard with their coat on, but that's when they get to be in person and talk to someone, has become much more valuable, which is kind of funny because I used to always complain that my students were always, you know, on their phones, like in the dining hall, and not talking to other real humans. I think now talking to other real humans has become more valuable, so that when we get out of this, we'll be prioritizing it even more.
Interesting. So you're not seeing the kids outside all on their phones together? They're actually interacting?
Yeah, I think, you know, like, you know, I remember from my college days, which, you know, I'm old enough that this was like, you know, not pre-internet, but pre-internet in the way we know it now, you know, pre-Instagram and these kinds of things. And, you know, I remember the, like, you know, late till 3 a.m. conversations, right? You know, if I had had billions of shows on Netflix and everything on Instagram and my entire Reddit feed, like, I don't know if I would have participated in those late night conversations as much. And I think, you know, because screens are just so ubiquitous right now, students want a break. And that means they're kind of returning to the in-person fun social connection that I remember and that I kind of feel like they're missing out on.
Yeah. So let's get to your podcast. So you do the Happiness Lab, which is great. And you have a whole bonus season on dealing with the pandemic. And one of the major challenges we're all facing now is loneliness. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about how to tackle loneliness, how we can deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the worst part of the pandemic, to be totally honest. I mean, obviously, this is a disease that's taking people's lives and, you know, it's ruining the economy and people's jobs and things. But I actually think it's most insidious in the way it increases loneliness, right? Like, we as humans, one of the best and most important things we need for our well-being is social connection, is just literally physically being around people. There are papers that show that people who are physically around other humans more often tend to be happier than those that aren't, right? And at this moment where we need our well-being hit so much, the virus is taking it away. But also, we also know that one way that we get through trauma and crises is by reaching out to the people we care about. You know, that's why, you know, in most cultures, funerals aren't just like you by yourself grieving. You know, everybody comes together to kind of hold each other's hands, give each other a hug. And, you know, I've needed that hug from so many of my friends that I can't see physically closely right now. And so I think, you know, this is something that we're all struggling with. But the good news is that we can use technologies like Zoom and things like that to kind of fill in the gap a little bit. I mean, you know, we're all, you know, in different time zones and different cities, and we're talking right now over Zoom. And, you know, it would be better and more fun if we were all in a studio together and could laugh and, you know, shake each other's hand or give a hug after this. But like, this is pretty good, right? We'll feel like we had some connection. And that's the advice. We need to just get more intentional about using technology kind of nutritiously to make social connection. I always use these kind of analogies with, you know, nutrition and eating and things. But I think we need to think about our social connection nutritiously. Like, you know, scrolling through your Instagram feed, that might feel good, but it's kind of like the junk food of social connection, right? You know, like kind of like empty calories. Like, we need the stuff that's going to take a while to cook, but feels really good. You know, like setting up that, you know, Zoom happy hour with your friends, you know, setting up a call where you're like the old-fashioned phone, pick up the phone to call a friend you haven't talked to. Those are the kinds of things that are going to sustain us. They take work because we have to set them up, but they're going to be the stuff that feels best.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask about. You know, what does the science tell us about what is the junk food of technology versus what's going to be more nutritious? It sounds like all of these things aren't created equally. So is there something that we know about text messages versus Zoom versus phone calls versus Zoom calls versus when I'm having a PlayStation chat and playing games with my friends? Like, what's the hierarchy there in terms of mitigating that loneliness?
Yeah, I think you get some insight when you think about what we're built for, you know, as primates, what we evolved to be, right? Like, we are social primates who evolved to be together in real life, in real time, you know, talking with a reasonably small number of people. You know, it's not like these big gatherings would happen. You know, usually it's kind of one-on-one or a couple people all together. The better technology mimics that, the better it feels for us, often the more nutritious it is. You know, so let's take something at the extreme, text messaging. You know, I text message you, you see it, it's in text, it's not in real time, right? I'm not seeing your emotional expressions, these kinds of things. That's, you know, that's going to be effective communication if it's the best you got, but that's not a way to really fully sustain our social connection, right? You know, let's take a Zoom call like this, right? We're not physically together, but we're in real time. You know, the audio is not perfect. That's why you tend to interrupt each other so much more as a podcaster doing my Happiness Lab episodes on Zoom. I notice I'm constantly interrupting people more than I ever used to, right? So it's not perfect, but I see your emotional expressions. We can kind of react in real time. That's pretty good. The other way, so one way we can think about it is like, how can we get closest to what we're naturally built to do? But another way is just like to mindfully reflect on what feels good. And I think this is what we all need to do more and more, right? It's like, just after you have a certain interaction, how did you feel? You know, when you like scroll through your Instagram feed for an hour, like, how do you feel afterwards? If you're like me, it might be like, I feel kind of gross, a little apathetic, right? You know, how did you feel after that Zoom happy hour? Well, you know, some days I'm, you know, enriched and feeling good and awake. If it was like an hour that I was on a Zoom happy hour after like millions of hours for work Zoom meetings, like, I feel kind of nasty, right? I needed to get up and move around, right? So the answer to what feels best is going to change, and that's okay too. I think the key is to mindfully pay attention to what it feels like, because the stuff we predict is going to feel good doesn't necessarily feel good. So we need to kind of do a recap afterwards to say, okay, how was that? And depending on how it went, build more of the stuff that's working, that feels nutritious.
Yeah. So much of, I feel like, dealing with this pandemic is sort of knowing the timeline, right? Knowing when it's going to end. And I was really struck by listening to your bonus season, how you discussed loneliness, I think in March. Like, we got to deal with loneliness. And it was like March 20th or something. And I was like, wow, that's prescient. But also, like, we had no idea it was going to go on for so long. How do you deal when you don't know when the end point is, right? And how it's constantly shifting. We were thinking it was going to be the spring, and now it's a summer, and maybe it's 2022. And then it's just like, who the hell knows? How do we deal with that?
Yeah, I think this is such a tough part of the pandemic. And so many of us have so many examples of this, right? You know, so the students here at Yale went home in March of 2020, right? You know, you're going home, but you'll be back soon. And one student gave me his little succulent, like, oh, can you take care of my succulent till you get back? Now, 10 months later, thank God I haven't killed the thing, but it's huge. I sent him a little picture of it. And he was like, wow, that's not mine. I'm like, no, it is. It just like got really big because it's been a year, basically, right?
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, we're all going through this uncertainty, and, you know, the best way to cure it would be to know, like, by, you know, March 15th, we're going to have a vaccine and everybody's going to be vaccinated. We don't, that's impossible right now, it seems, right? And so I think that means we just need good strategies to deal with that uncertainty and the anxiety that comes with it. And one of my favorite strategies for this is just taking time, almost through like a meditation practice, to recognize your emotion. If that emotion's uncertainty, like, you call it what it is. This is uncertainty with a twinge of anxiety, or this is uncertainty with a huge twinge of frustration right now. And then kind of allow it, just sit there and say, all right, you know, I don't like this uncertainty, but let's like hang out with it and process it for a bit. And then you can kind of do some bodily investigation with it. Like, how does that uncertainty feel in your body when you notice it? You know, for me, it's like my chest is feeling tight, right? You know, it's kind of like similar to anxiety, but I also come with like urges to do things. Like, when I'm feeling extra uncertain, that's when I get this like craving to run to the fridge and grab something sweet, or that craving to kind of go on social media and distract myself. But if you really kind of investigate and hang out with that feeling, you know, you can kind of get through it. The only way around our feelings is actually through them, right? And so taking time to experience it can be good. And then you sort of take some time to nurture that feeling, right? Like, it sucks to be this uncertain. What can you do to really nurture yourself? Not distract yourself, but like, again, get that social connection. You know, take time to do something that you really will enjoy. You know, get some exercise or some movement in, right? Like, what does your body, what does your mind really need right now to feel better? That practice of recognizing, allowing, investigating, and nurturing is one I totally stole from the meditation teacher Tara Brach. She uses the acronym RAIN to talk about that process. But it's just such an easy way to, you know, be with your emotions. I think, you know, when negative stuff comes up, whether it's uncertainty in the pandemic or loneliness or just all these feelings, we want to to run away from them, but taking time to diagnose what they are and really recognize like, oh, wait, this isn't uncertainty. This is pissed off, right? This is I'm annoyed, right? Or this is fear, you know, this is anxiety. When we notice these things, we can actually act on them in the right way. You know, then I realize it's not like a craving for something sweet. You know, I need something else. I need to deal with the uncertainty and process it.
Yeah, yeah. We actually had Tara Brach on for an episode that just to let our listeners know. And of course, you know, I listened to her whole explanation of her RAIN technique. And I was like, yes, yes, very wise. And then it just went whoosh right over my head. And I continued back to like scrolling through Instagram all day. But anyway, Jordan, you had a question.
I did. So that makes me want to ask about stoicism and the Stoics. And that's something that there was a bonus episode on the Happiness Lab as well. So I read this book last year, and it was basically my first introduction into Stoicism. It was called The Anecdote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. And that sort of cynical sounding title just went straight to my heart. And since I read the book, you know, I soaked it up. I really enjoyed it. I was like, yes, this is very wise. This is way profound. And then when I tried to explain it to someone else, just what Stoicism was and how it could be useful, I sucked at it. I just felt like just rambling, incoherent. And it was something that I felt that I understood, but you can't really tell how well you understand something until you try to explain it to someone else, that type of thing. So can you do a better job? Anyone can do better than me, but can you explain what Stoicism is and how those types of approaches can help with some of the anxiety and challenges people might be having right now?
Yeah, yeah. And I want to say at the outset, like, I love the fact that, you know, that nasty title drew you in. I think, you know, much of the work on happiness has like a branding problem where it sounds like some cheesy hippy dippy stuff that, you know, makes me want to gag. And so I'm with you on this. Like,
right,
we need better words for this. But Stoicism is a case where I think the word messes us up. When we think of Stoics, we think of people who are unemotional and like just really hard-edged or something
right,
like that.
Exactly.
And that's actually not what it's about at all. You know, my favorite way of explaining Stoicism comes from one of the most famous Stoic books by this guy, Epictetus. And he started his book with this idea that there are two things in the world. There are things that you can control and there are things that you can't control. You know, the fact that the vaccines aren't rolling out as quickly as I want. You know, the fact that my students are uncertain about whether they can stay on campus this semester. The fact that I can't see my friends. All those I can't control. But here are the things I can't control. My reaction to those things, you know, whether I call a friend or not, you know, whether I pull out my yoga mat and get a good workout in because that'll make me feel good. Those are the things I can control. And what the Stoics say is, if you focus on the stuff you can control, nobody can force you to have a negative emotion, right? You know, you can't control the stuff that's happening, but like what your reaction to it is, you can control. And the Stoics were into positive emotions. That's kind of the misnomer that they didn't like emotions. They loved positive emotions, but they're like, those negative emotions, they kind of suck. So I'm going to do everything I can to reframe bad events as not being so bad, right? And, you know, one of their techniques that we talk about in the podcast is this form of reframing where you try to see bad events as sort of a game that's sort of letting you level up, you know, like, you know, you grab the, you know, milk out of the fridge and it falls on the floor. You know, you could be like, oh, like I'm so mad, spilled milk. Or you could be like, Okay, Stoic gods, game on, right? Like, it's going to be this kind of day today. Like, you're not going to ruffle me, right? Like, the game is like, how much bad stuff can you take without being ruffled, right? And when you start to see it like that, you know, then you're kind of playing along, right? Then it's kind of like you're working to reframe things in ways that feel positive, right? You know, the game is about how much can I get through without getting pissed or sad or, you know, lonely or whatever? Like, how much can I fight back when circumstances are coming at me? And now you take the bad things on as a challenge. It kind of becomes fun. Not like anyone would have wished this pandemic, but now that it's here, you're like, okay, this is my time to like flex my stoicism muscles. Like, I'm going to be stronger and be at a new level at the end of this. And I think that's just a great, super powerful attitude. I mean, that's what the research suggests. This kind of reframing as a game rather than a, you know, a horrible thing that's happening to us, it can allow us to get through things and to get through things with a little bit more humor than we would have otherwise.
I love this technique so much. I'm wondering, can you reward yourself after overcoming a challenge?
You can. But I think if you recognize it as such, then it's sort of good. You know, I mean, I have this, you know, like so many examples of these kinds of cases. You know, one was a case where, you know, right in the middle of the pandemic, I was actually just getting curbside pickup somewhere because that's what we're limited to. It was one of those weeks when I like hadn't been out of the house at all. And I was just like driving up to the grocery to pop my trunk so that, you know, somebody could stick groceries in. And I stepped out of the car to pop my trunk. And there was this big pothole and I twisted my ankle and sprained my ankle super badly. And I was kind of like, you know, at first I was like, whoa, it's me. This is so awful. And then I was like, wait a minute, game on. Like, you're not going to get me that. You know, there's one, the one time I'm out of my house and you give a pothole, like, okay, okay, good, good, good on you, Stoic gods. That was a good one. You know, like that was a like weird challenge, right? But it becomes funny, right? It becomes this thing that I'm going to try to get through, you know, and funny. And so in that way, you don't actually need the reward. The reward is that like, now I can go home and joke to my husband. Or now I can say, like, thank God it was just sprained and not broken, right? You know, thank God it healed really quickly. You know, could have been worse, right? Like, you quickly get in the mode of feeling better. And so you don't need to, like, give yourself an actual cookie at the end. Your positive emotion winds up being that cookie that you get from this approach.
I want a cookie, though.
You can have a cookie, too.
Jordan, I want
don't
a cookie.
Don't let anyone stop you from getting that cookie, Alex. Okay. I am all about just finding reasons to celebrate.
Thank you.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
So I'm thinking about, big picture wise, how much should people chase happiness? Sometimes when I think of happiness as a bigger concept, I think of, you know, if you have that sort of speck in your eye that you try to look at, and the more you try to look at it directly, the more it just sort of floats away. Is that happiness? Like, is that something that people should actively be thinking about and working on? Or should people focus their attention on something else and let happiness just be sort of this byproduct?
Yeah, I think kind of yes and no, right? I mean, I think, honestly, if you were seeking out happiness the right way, the way you would do that is to focus on other stuff and let happiness be a byproduct, right? I think the problem is it's not bad that we go after happiness. It's bad that we go after happiness in the wrong way. And this is really what the podcast is all about. You know, we go through all these misconceptions that we have about what's going to make for a happier life. The biggest one is, to be happier, I need to change my circumstances. You know, when I get a new job, when I get a new relationship, when my salary goes up, when this pandemic is over, I will be happy, right? And the research just suggests, surprisingly, that's not the case. You can look at people with fantastic circumstances who are absolutely miserable. And you could look at people who are going through traumatic, awful events that you would never wish on your worst enemy, who see those events not just as something that's not making them unhappy, but also as something that's like building them up. You know, we in the podcast, we actually interview people who've been through just awful, awful circumstances. You know, a new soldier who was just starting out in Iraq and his Humvee was blown up so that he was burned over 3/4 of his body. You know, he couldn't have the military career he had hoped for. And he also was like, you know, burned, his good looks were gone. And he says that that event was a positive thing in his life. You know, it changed his life in a positive way. And this is the shocking thing about our circumstances, that people who go through the worst circumstances we could imagine often say that there was more good than bad that came from those circumstances, right? And so this is the problem with this idea of chasing happiness. It's not that we shouldn't chase after happiness. It's just that when we go about chasing it, we do it wrong. So we're going after this stuff full throttle that's not making us happy, rather than be like, maybe my approach is wrong. We double down and we're like, well, that first $1 million didn't make me happy, but now if I get 2 million, or that one job change didn't make me happy, but maybe if I get a different new job again, right? And so I think that's the issue. So if we really want to focus on what actually makes us happy, usually it's things that are much simpler than we think. It's things like taking time to be present, you know, taking time for social connection, moving our body, getting enough sleep, right? You know, when you go after that stuff, it doesn't feel like you're chasing after happiness, you're chasing after that speck in your eye that's so elusive. You're just like doing the stuff that you should normally do as a human. But it turns out that that can come with a lot of like well-being at the end.
I feel like I've read a while ago, and I'm not up on the latest studies, that there's like a happiness set point, right? That we all have sort of a level that we naturally kind of just rest at wherever we, whatever bad happens to us, whatever good happens to us, we just regain this sort of point. Is that true? And if so, how much can we adjust that?
Yeah, so there is lots of evidence that we kind of have this set point heritably, meaning that, you know, there's something in our genes or some sort of complicated interaction between our genes, our environment, that allow us, that allow some people to just kind of naturally be happy and some people to be naturally not so happy. Actually, my genetic set point is to naturally be not so happy. So, you know, I didn't really win the happiness lottery there. But the research also suggests that you can take a lot of action to move that around. So you're naturally going to be kind of somewhere, but actually through certain behaviors, you can get happier. But again, they're not the behaviors we think. You know, that set point that you're talking about is that, you know, if you get a new job that's fantastic, that'll feel good for a while, but you'll sort of adapt to that. You'll kind of naturally go back to your set point. So a lot of the stuff we go after has that feature of like, oh, it's good for a while, but then we kind of go back to our set point. Same thing with bad things. You know, it's a bad event, but, you know, I broke up with my partner, but then you kind of, you know, you get over it slowly over time too. But there are things that can naturally move us from our set point, but again, they're not the things we expect. They're things like increasing our social connection, taking time for gratitude, becoming more present. Turns out people that are genetically wired for happiness just tend to do that stuff more. They're more social, they're more present. They naturally count their blessings, right? So if you're not a kind of natural happy set point person, you can copy the behaviors of happy people, the ones that really work, and then kind of move your set point around.
We've talked about this indirectly, and I would love it if we just talked about money directly as something that there's obviously, you know, there's that old sort of famed research about, you know, your money can buy happiness up to a certain point, you know, $75,000 or whatever figure that it gives. And then I think just yesterday, the day before yesterday, I saw that there was this other study that's obviously going to combat that and saying that money actually does buy happiness because of X, Y, and Z reasons. Can we talk a little bit about that? You know, what's the relationship really? How do you see it between money and happiness, and to the extent that money affects your happiness?
Yeah, so, you know, you're referring to one of the most famous papers in the field. It was actually by Kahneman and Deaton. These are two Nobel Prize winning economists who separately won the Nobel Prize. So they each separately won a Nobel Prize and then did this very famous happiness study. And what they found was that money does make you happier up to a point. And that was that $75,000. So the idea is, this is a study back in the early 2000s. You know, if you earn less than $75,000 in the US, if you're earning only $10,000 a year and you double your salary, yeah, you know, you're probably going to more easily put food on your table, not worry about rent. That's really going to have an impact on your happiness. But they found that that impact on your happiness kind of leveled off in their data set. And it leveled off around $75,000. What does that mean? That meant that in their data set, even if I double or triple your salary, you're not going to experience any more happiness. Happiness in this case as defined as positive emotion, not experiencing many negative emotions, and not experiencing much stress. This was the sort of famous effect. And you're right, you know, science does new data and does new studies, and this new paper that just came out last week, the title of which is like, money does make you happier. But when you dig into the data, what you realize is like, yeah, but, right? You know, this study, to be fair, like had a much better technique. It did this experience sampling on people's cell phones to kind of ping them at different times. It used this huge sample. But even then, when you look at it, they find that, yeah, money does make you happier, but the effect is like super, 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 super tiny, right? There's so many other things you could do other than bumping up your salary that would work much better. So for example, the effect of money on happiness they found is much less than the effect of if you just meditated for 5 minutes a day, or if you just got an extra hour sleep, or if you just made a call to a friend and increased your social connection. And so a colleague of mine said the paper should have been titled, "Money Can Make You Incredibly Marginally Happier, but not as happier as like most other interventions you could do." It's a very expensive intervention to get a teensy, teensy, tiny, you know, boost in happiness. And I love papers like this because we have this intuition so strongly. You know, Matt Killingsworth, the person who did the new paper, is an incredibly smart researcher. And I get kind of where he's coming from, where it's like, that can't possibly be true. You know, if you had $1 billion, you definitely must be happier. And it's true. Maybe you'd be happier, but a teensy, 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 tiny bit happier. And to spend all your time trying to become a billionaire, you're probably not going to see your friends. You're not going to sleep as much. You're probably not going to have much presence, right? You'd just be so much better off investing in this other stuff. And so, yeah. So I think the jury says, yeah, you know, up to $75,000, money makes you kind of a lot happier, especially if you're at lower incomes. After $75,000, money makes you a teensy, 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 tiny bit happier. But, you know, if you were really kind of trying to put your time into good use, you'd focus on something other than money.
Yeah, I think money is a prime example of this, but don't we have kind of the wrong idea about what could make us happy? Like, I know for myself, I always think like, I need a big house. But then there's a part of me that's like, I know that's not right, because then I'm just going to be isolated, you know, in some, I don't know, in some imaginary mansion that I'm going to have in an estate somewhere. But you know, so can you talk a little bit about that stuff? Like, what are the other things that we kind of get wrong about happiness?
Yeah, money is a huge one. Stuff is a huge one. Awesome stuff. I think we all think buying more stuff will make us happy. And that's why the storage business industry is a multi-billion dollar industry in the US, because we bought all this stuff thinking it was going to work and it's not working. So we like stick it in some storage thing. We still don't want to get rid of it, interestingly enough, even though it's not working. So we kind of leave it somewhere. Another thing that we really think is going to make us happy, in fact, is like, again, just all these changes of circumstances, like new relationship, new job, new vacation. I'm going to get this stuff. And again, all these good things give us a teeny boost of happiness, but that boost is less big than we think. And the interesting thing is it doesn't last. This is this phenomenon that researchers call hedonic adaptation, which is just a fancy way of saying we get used to stuff. When you buy that new phone, like when I got my first smartphone, or I bought the latest iPhone, that first day, it's really cool, right? I'm playing with all the gadgets and it's so much brighter than my other phone and so on. But then a week later, it's just my phone, right? Like I'm not getting any extra rewardingness out of it, right? And that's pretty much everything we can buy. You know, your new house, when you first, the big new house mansion that you might get in this fictional world, when you get the big new fictional mansion, it's going to be awesome for the first day when you're running around. But then it's just going to be your house. You're used to it. And it's going to be a pain in the butt. You got to clean it. You know, it's probably further away from your job, you know, because like, you know, commuting and things, that's going to be yucky. All these other things we don't predict wind up being part of our decisions too. And those things can decrease our happiness rather than increase it.
How long does it take for our brains to adjust to the boost that we get from, you know, Alice getting this new large house somewhere, or me finally paying off my student loans, or someone like, you know, getting something that's sort of a boost that we know is temporary? How long is temporary?
Yeah. It depends on, you know, the effect, right? You know, if you hit the lottery, that might be different than, you know, you eat a good cookie, right? You know, both of those are, in both of those cases, something good is happening. And we're probably making some prediction about how happy it's going to make us feel and how long it's going to last. But in every case that's been studied, pretty much, whatever we predict the happiness boost is going to be, and however long we predict the happiness boost is going to be, it's less than that. Right. One of the most famous studies, because academics are nerds and they only study nerdy things that academics care about, they looked at academics getting tenure. You know, so when a professor gets tenure and they have a job for life, it's super awesome. So they ask professors to predict how happy are you going to be and how long is it going to last? And what they find is it's not as good as you think. Like, it's the bump is less big. And we think, oh, the bump's going to last long forever. But like, as soon as you get tenure, literally the day I got tenure, my department emailed me and was like, hey, do you want this really horrible administrative job where you have to spend all these time citing schedules and all these things? Like, my happiness boost was like, it was gone immediately as soon as I took that new horrible job, right? And so we predict these things are going to last for a really long time, but they don't. And so the answer is like, it's definitely different for different things. You know, getting married is different than, you know, eating a chocolate bar, you know, in terms of the changes and the length. But in every case, it's not as big a boost as we think, and it's not as long of a boost as we think. And the great news, you know, that's true for negative events too, right? Those researchers also asked people, what if you don't get tenure? What's your prediction? And some of those, you know, academics didn't get tenure and they predict it's going to be awful. You know, it's going to be the lowest of the low and it's going to last forever. And that's an even bigger effect. We predict bad events are going to hit our happiness really horribly and for a long time, but they don't. Why? You know, we rationalize, you know, we grab that tub of ice cream when we need it. You know, we hang out with friends, right? We have lots of mechanisms to make ourselves feel better. You know, I think, you know, if you had asked me in March, hey, what's going to happen if this pandemic lasts a year? How bad is it going to be? And I would have been like, this would be devastating. And it's not been a bowl of cherries, but it probably wasn't as bad as I would have thought it was if you asked me back then.
Yeah, we're just way more resilient than we give ourselves credit for.
Which is kind of sad, right? Like, we have this superpower to get over really bad stuff and we don't realize it. And that's bad for our happiness too, right? You know, that means, you know, sometimes I don't do things, right? Because I'm scared to do them. You know, I'm going to take this risk, but maybe I'll apply for this job and not get it. Or maybe I'll, you know, when I was single, maybe I'll ask this person out, but they might say no. I'm making all these predictions about what would happen to my happiness if I got rejected or if something bad happened, you know, if I tried out a new sport and I was not good at it, right? I'm making these predictions about how I'm going to react. And I don't realize you're going to react great. You're so much more resilient than you think. I think if we recognize that, we'd do more. We'd take more good risks in our lives.
Laurie, thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you so much, Laurie. That's absolutely amazing.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Now it's time for Upgrade of the Week, where we talk about that one thing that's making a big difference in our lives. Alice, what's your upgrade?
So I can't believe I'm saying this, but my upgrade this week is I quit caffeine.
What?
Alex. It's insane. And it doesn't feel...
Are you okay?
I don't think I am. First of all, little background. I love coffee, as you know. I think my last upgrade was about coffee. I am also hyper sensitive to caffeine. I can't drink it after noon. I can't drink more than... If I have like more than one cup, I'm having like a... I'm like unto a god. I'm having like a manic experience. I have to like really keep it to like... maybe a cup. A cup is pushing it. Like a half cup is ideal for me. Even then, I'm super sensitive to it. It has not been great for me. Anxiety-wise, I've been like, you know, things are, it's an anxious time, as you know. So I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna do it. I'm just gonna get rid of it. And I've tried this before and failed. So I just did it super gradually. And that's always the key. I don't know why I haven't done that before.
Gotta wean yourself off.
No, I've gone cold turkey. Had like a lost weekend of like headaches, like just, you know, and that doesn't work because then you're miserable and you rebound. But I just really, really super gradually weaned myself off. And last week I realized like I had a doctor's appointment in the morning and didn't have any caffeine. And yeah, like at the end of the day, I was like, I've had no caffeine and I feel fine.
Nice.
And it's like a superpower.
Do you think it's easier or harder working from home and abstaining from caffeine? You know, would it be harder if you were passing by coffee shops on your way to work?
Well, I am still having decaf. So the milk frother upgrade I had from last week still stands.
Still valid.
I bought myself some nice decaf beans, you know, so I felt like I'm still having my little morning treat. So that's like a tiny, tiny bit of caffeine. So there's still, and I also have chocolate because I'm not a monster. So, you know, there's that. But I don't think that would make it harder. It is a little bit easier because I'm home. You know, if I do have like a terrible headache or something, I could just like lie down for a few minutes. That's harder to do when you're in the office. But I haven't. I haven't really, because I've really been super, super gradual with it. It also made me realize that caffeine stays in my system way longer than I thought. Because
really,
like I once didn't have a headache for one day and then the next day had like a horrible headache. And I was like, oh, it's like in my system for 48 hours. So,
man.
Yeah. So I'm caffeine free.
Well, congratulations.
We'll see how long
and
it
condolences.
Lasts. Thank you. Yeah. I'll accept that. Jordan, what's your upgrade?
So my upgrade this week is related to an executive order that was recently signed and something that I've probably talked about a lot on this podcast very randomly, which is student loans. So there was an executive order that was signed that pushes back student loan payments until, like, there's no interest now until the end of September. So September 30th would be the last day before student loan interest picks up again. And there's so much financial advice out there that I was reading that was saying, you know, if you can afford it, to pay on your principal, keep doing monthly payments. And my upgrade for myself is disregarding that advice because I sort of think some of it is bad advice. And here's why. So originally, student loans were supposed to pick up at the end of 2020, then it got deferred to March. Now it's the end of September, and you could make monthly payments on your principal, or since the economy still sucks and you still don't know what emergency you might run into, you can just hold on to that money and save it in a savings account and get some nominal interest rate rather than making monthly payments. And you're basically just, or at least I'm basically having a bigger emergency safety net is what I'm trying to sort of bulk up for myself rather than making monthly payments, specifically because there's no benefit in me paying monthly principal if there's no interest rate.
Right.
Like if there's zero interest rate, there's no difference from me paying this month and next month and the following month versus just making a big lump sum on September 29th
right.
or September 30th.
Right.
Like September 30th is when I'm going to pay what I would have been paying monthly to try to do the exact same thing, which is pay down principal on student loans, but not having to do it in a way that sacrifices a safety net because the economy still sucks. And yeah. I could break my leg tomorrow. I could lose my job tomorrow. I could have some precarious, horrible situation happen to me between now and September. And there's no reason for me to sacrifice that financial flexibility for literally no good reason because there's no interest until the fall.
Yeah.
So that's my personal upgrade financially is saving money to pay off principal balance on my student loans, but not doing it monthly like a lot of sort of lazy advice has told me. I think I'm going to sort of subvert that a little bit and hold off until just before interest picks up and then pay then.
Right. Hang on to it. And if you, and then you don't, and when you need it, if you need it, you have it. You're still liquid.
Right. It's sort of a win-win. Like I could still, you know, hit the principal at the end of it. But on the off chance that something terrible happens in my life, I also could actually use that money. And that's what it's there for. It's there to like give people relief in case of, you know, they've been affected by this pandemic and having an emergency. And by paying the student loan payments now, it would be sort of assuming that I still can't have an emergency or be affected by the pandemic when that's not true.
Right, right. I think, as our three-time guest, Ramit Sethi, would say, like, you know, keep yourself as liquid as possible in this time. I think he would approve.
Yeah, yeah.
There
so
you
that's,
go.
That's my upgrade this week.
Nice
feeling
upgrade.
Good about it.
All right, I think you should feel good about it. And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck and mixed by Brad Fisher.
Please rate us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. You can always reach us by phone as well by calling 347-687-8109 and leaving us a voicemail, or you can email us at upgrade@lifehacker.com.
You can also find us on Twitter @lifehacker, on Instagram @lifehacker.com, all one word, and on Facebook @facebook.com/lifehacker. Sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter full of tips and tricks and hacks @lifehacker.com/newsletter. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade @lifehacker.com/the show.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.